I'm happy now to welcome to the show Ann Weaver. She is a paleoanthropologist, and she's author of the new book, Children of Time. And Matt Selesky is a natural history illustrator. He's the illustrator of that book. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So this book, Children of Time, the subtitle is Becoming Human. It starts with ancient hominids, basically, our ancestors, and you make a narrative in which you actually, by, I guess, a combination of imagination and research, go back to what life might have been like for our ancestors, starting with, what, a couple of million years ago?
Yeah, about 2.5 million years ago. Mm-hmm. Trying to depict life through the eyes of those of the children of those ancestors was my original aim.
And so the book is, although you know, it's a book for all ages, as you say, it's basically aimed toward elementary or middle school children.
Probably more middle school.
So how did you reconstruct, what were the factual research tools that you used to try to make narratives about their lives?
The first thing I did was I looked up absolutely every piece of primary research I could find. I looked at lists of what kind of animal bones were found at every site. I looked at all the lists of tools in the archaeology that, and the, all the analyses about how are these tools used, and some of the tools have been analyzed for residue. So what were they used for? Were they used to scrape hides? Were they used to scrape wood? Were they used to break bones for marrow? And then I also looked at the physical bodies, the remains of the physical bodies, the bones, the fossilized bones of these individuals. And there's a huge body of analysis. My field in paleoanthropology and how I got into it was the idea you can actually take the shape of a bone and deduce its function from that shape. And so I took all of that and I put it together with my imagination to make the stories.
What are the things, I mean, you just mentioned some of the things that we can know. For example, what animals were around. First of all, where, in the very first chapter, where are we located in geographical space?
We're in South Africa, and the fossil depicted in that story is from a site called Tong, and it's one of the very earliest hominid fossils that was ever discovered and was very controversial at the time. But the guy who discovered it, his name was Raymond Dart, I think he discovered it in 23 or 24. He looked at this little skull and he said, it's different from an ape skull because the little hole at the bottom of the skull where the spine goes through is actually moved too far forward for it to be an ape skull. It looks like this was a skull that was balanced on an upright body. And so we start in South Africa with a very classic fossil, the Tong child.
And so at the time it was controversial because the idea of a bipedal pre-Homo sapien was unknown.
It was unknown, and also because this individual had a very small brain, and everybody's picture of what makes us special and what makes us human is our brains. And here was an individual who had taken a step along the path to humanhood, but its brain really looked very much like an ape brain. And that was tremendously controversial. And also, of course, it was found in Africa. And at that time, especially among the paleoanthropology establishment, which was very European, the idea that our first ancestor would be African was also controversial.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Now it's
we take it for granted. We totally take it for granted. Mm-hmm.
So what are some of the things that we don't know because there's no fossil evidence about those times and places?
The big one is language. We do not know when language evolved. And that's a hot topic. It's a controversial topic that people treat in different ways. And another thing, and I wanted to explore this in the stories, is how did morality evolve? And so I put the characters into various moral dilemmas just to show what kind of dilemma they might have had to face in that very deep past. And we don't know, there's no way we can know how any individual felt or reacted. What we do know, for one thing, is how mammals react. They're playful. They grieve. And then if you look not just at mammals, but then at our close relatives, the the primates, they very specifically grieve and do, in some instances, try and help each other out. And so I think there's a justification for saying there's a moral spectrum or a moral continuum, and I just depicted it more to put it out there as a hypothesis than, because we can't, you're right, we can't possibly know those things.
Well, and I was thinking about language. I mean, we've determined, you know, just on this show a few weeks ago, we had a scientist on talking about prairie dog language. They've got nouns, verbs, and adjectives.
I know. Prairie dogs are incredible. Yes.
And so I was thinking about that, and you in the first chapter had more like gruntings for the early hominids. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to believe that they were less sophisticated than prairie dogs.
It definitely is. And I did have them making sounds related specifically to various dangers. So it wasn't just totally random gruntings. But I wasn't thinking that they were, I think even prairie dogs don't have language in the really highly symbolic and complex sense that we do. And, well, of course.
That's debate for another
controversy. But I was looking at parrots, apes, all of whom, Coco the gorilla makes up words.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to bring it to that level and maybe push it just a tiny little bit in that chapter and then elaborate a little further in the next chapter.
Now, in illustrating a book like this, I would think that you have to, Matt Selesky, on the one hand, try to be as true to life and place as possible, but also make them accessible to kids who want to find something to relate to in the illustrations.
Definitely. I think one of the great joys I had working with this book was I did get to play a little bit with both the technical side of things, and there's a huge body of work with lots of artists over the years have done scientific reconstructions of many of these exact same specimens that we're talking about, like the Tong child. But if you look at any two of them, there are big differences, even though they're starting from the same point. So, you know, there's the scientific end of it, but also with Anne's story, there's real character development. I mean, a lot of these hominids have, I don't think personality is too strong of a word to use. They have a kind of consistency of action, and it is part of a narrative. So you need to show them, you know, if they're excited or if they're frightened or concerned, you know, mixing that emotion into the faces and the body language without going too far over the edge and making them look too human, especially early on, was an interesting challenge.
Well, and it's there are places where, and I wonder how you keep from doing this. Maybe it's impossible, but how do you keep from bringing your own cultural baggage and assumptions into a narrative? I mean, the very idea of writing a narrative is such a relatively modern thing.
And that's something I don't think you can keep from doing that. But what for me, the whole process was fascinating because of being able to reflect on that issue. So what would it have been like if I could strip away my own culture and I'm standing on the hot savanna and I'm really interested in rocks? What would that have been like? What would I have faced? And you can take some pretty basic human emotions. And then, you're right, I can't remove my own culture from it. But I really tried hard to, if I were going to do, for example, a metaphor, to do it, to compare the phenomenon to something that would have been in the experience. So the sky was as gray as flint.
Right.
Something like that. But of course you can't, if you're writing a narrative, you're writing it as a cultural being. So, yeah.
One thing that I was wondering about is, and correct me if I misread this, but in the chapter called Ceremony of Returning, which takes place 26,000 years ago, you have essentially a kind of Romeo and Juliet story. Mm-hmm. Romantic love is less than 1,000 years old, and marriage is less than 4,000 years old. And you set them in 26,000 years ago.
They're in a culture that makes art. They're in a culture that certainly has to figure out a way to regulate the relationships between males and females to get the children cared for. They're definitely, I went to the Czech Republic. This is one of the sites that I actually got to go with and I go to and actually spoke with one of the longtime excavators who is convinced there were two very distinct cultures going on in the region at the time. And so how do two groups interact? And what if a male from one is interested in a female from another or vice versa? So it's certainly an exploration, but I think, and I also think that sexual attraction is way older than 4,000 years.
Sexual attraction is, and but even, marriage is a very different thing than sexual attraction.
And we don't...
Dogs don't get married.
Dogs don't get married. And there are, however, lots of kind of animals who make lifelong pair bonds, who court each other,
right,
with
but not,
presents.
Not very many primates.
Not very many primates. And at some point, we started to do that. And I think it had to be, I think the roots of that had to be much longer ago.
Well, this is one part where I just, my mouth dropped open.
Really?
I said,
huh?
Yeah, no
you were
way.
Gonna, okay.
I'm not buying it.
Okay, well, that's fun.
No, but I mean, I suppose this is the kind of thing that's going to come up with the students, which
absolutely.
Is what this is all about, the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young mm-hmm. Thinkers.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. And I would stand by the courting behavior. And I would stand by...
Based on what?
Well, there is even some courting in other primates, in apes. It mostly has to do with, like, pieces of raw meat. But...
Right, but there marriage and saying, oh, you two love birds and stuff like that. I mean, it was like out of a 1960s sitcom.
And I don't think you can eliminate it just because we only have written records back to 4,000 years about pair bonding or that kind of hormonal response to each other that ends up with gifting, that ends up with being recognized, with especially in a small group. I mean, you've got to figure out a way, if you have a small group of individuals, which were living, say, in those incredibly harsh conditions 26,000 years ago, you have to figure out a way to take care of the kids. And one very good solution to do that is pair bonding. So I would still stand up for it as a really reasonable alternative. I just think it's maybe too... we're too culturally, narrowly bonded if we say we're the only ones that have invented that. As a matter of fact, most modern humans, and the majority of modern humans up until modern times, have been in much more polygynous societies, polygamous societies. So I didn't actually want to get into that in a kid's book. I didn't really want to get into polygamy. But I still think that you could say one thing that makes us very human is our... the way we make families.
We're talking to Ann Weaver about the new book, Children of Time, Becoming Human. Matt Selesky, so there are some really wonderful, I guess you might call them portraits mm-hmm. of these early hominids and going more toward the present. And you have the skulls next to the reconstructed portraits. That is really... as much a work of science as of illustration.
Well, I mean, there's definitely a lot of science that factors into it. You know, and I don't really consider myself a scientist in the rigorous sense. I'm not doing this and putting it out there for rigorous peer review or publication. But there is a lot of anatomy that goes into it. There's well, I mean, just even basic proportions. That was one thing that I struggled with early on in the process. And Ann and I had a lot of back and forth where I was sending her sketches and she would mark them up in Photoshop and send it back. And I think that really helped me get a lot better handle on, you know, what the external changes to the faces of these early hominids, which is really kind of the key into seeing them as individuals. That process helped us, you know, get to a point where it was both scientifically accurate and had a little bit of the character that we talked about before. The amount of rigor that goes into reconstructing fossil hominids, it can be, there's quite a spectrum. There are people that go from, you know, dissecting primates to and then reconstructing the muscles. No primates were harmed in the making of this book. I think I should say that right now. Luckily, you know, I was able to work off of the work of others for a lot of the real detailed musculature. But yeah, it all starts with the fossils.
Let's talk about predators and prey. Early humans, hominids, prehumans were both prey and predators. Who ate us and whom did we eat?
The tongue child, for example, was supposedly carried off by an eagle. For a long time, the received wisdom was that it was carried off by a leopard. And somehow the leopard dropped it from a tree branch over the cave where it ultimately was found. And then someone took the talons of an eagle and measured them, a large African eagle, and measured them to fit exactly into two small holes in the skull of the tongue child. So especially small primates were probably the prey of anybody who could get near them, of any creature that could get near them, from eagles to leopards to lions. By the time you get to Homo habilis, to the second story, you find collections at Olduvai Gorge, for example, of hominid bones that have scratches on them that were obviously made by stone tools. There have been detailed analyses of these with electron microscopes. So those things were made by stone tools, but overlaying those, say they're a hippopotamus bone or a horse bone, you find some predator tooth marks. And then on some other bones, you find predators' tooth marks under the hominid tool bones. So it sounds like we had an ecological community where people were actually people, early ancestors and predators were competing in a way that you see today with a sequence where today the vultures come in, say, after the lions get their fill. And that's what I was trying to depict, is that kind of sequence. And at a certain point, however, we get better than them, for the most part. We're still, I mean, I would not go out into, say, the African savanna today all by myself in the middle of the night necessarily, because I'm afraid I would become prey.
Right.
So, but at some point, we understood much more about the habits of various animals, and then we're able... We had control of fire, we had control of weaponry, and got more and more sophisticated. So does that answer that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was reading it thinking of myself as being a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old reading this book and wondering, so what did they eat? What were their mm-hmm. favorite things to eat?
Mm-hmm. The early ones I depicted as frugivores and fruit eaters. And you can tell this by looking at their teeth. So... our teeth, just like our bones, are built for function. So if you have big, flat, wide front incisor teeth, that's pretty good for biting off a piece of fruit. If you have, and so I depicted the tongue child as just moving away from that from fruit eating. So there are figs available, and there's a scene where they're dashing around, basically drunken on fig juice. And then also when times got tough, they had pretty sizable molars. We're starting to get quite sizable molars where they would be able to eat tough foods, dry foods, roots, tubers, maybe tender leaves. And there's some evidence even in their bones that the various hominids lived in different environments, drier environments. And that matches up with later ones, for example, the ones Nutcracker Man, they call Australopithecus. later Australopithecus Boisei, for example, had molars that are the size of quarters. They're enormous surfaces, and some good evidence that they lived in a very dry climate. So you can tell that. And then later, meat came in. Certainly with Homo habilis, there's good evidence that they were defleshing the bones, probably eating marrow, and became more and more and more important. And it was probably half... If you find something to scavenge, you'll scavenge it. There are people who live today and still will scavenge meat if they find it, but they'll also be skilled hunters. So, and whatever you could catch.
Now, when did cooking start?
Well, there is a controversy. It depends when you really believe that we got control of fire. And there are people who advocate for 1.5 million years ago, and another school that advocates for maybe 400,000 or 500,000 years ago. So there's a million-year gap in what we understand, where we understand we got control of fire. And I had the forest fire, the grass fire, cooked the termites, mites in the first chapter.
Right.
I think you can see animals perfectly aware of what they're going to find after a little grass fire. So it could have been we didn't control it, but we certainly allowed nature to cook it for us.
And we probably liked carbonized things just as much then as now.
I imagine. Nice, greasy. Yes, yum.
Now, after each chapter, you have a nonfiction explanatory section about the fossils on which your work was based.
Yeah.
And so all of that is science that then... the young people reading it can be inspired to go and do their own research on this period and these fossils.
I hope so, yeah. And to make their own search into the past and answer their own, for their own selves, what makes us human. That was part of it. And part of it was that all the time I was writing it, I sort of had the faces of my mentors sitting on my shoulder, and I'm thinking, man, I am going to have to defend this. So,
yeah.
So well, I wanted to be as rigorous as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And the question of what makes us human, I mean, in the years that I've been doing this program, the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, each thing that supposedly makes us human turns out to be shared by other species. They keep on crossing things off the list, like language, for example.
Yep. And tool use.
And tool use.
Mm-hmm. So, indeed. And so then it becomes, it isn't so much a checklist, but a pattern. And how is that integrated uniquely in us? Just like our bodies. There are other mammals that have thumbs. Koalas have two thumbs. So the opposable thumb isn't biologically unique.
Two thumbs.
That oppose.
On each hand?
On each hand. That actually can twist around just like our opposable thumb, twist around and meet the other fingers face to face. So even the thumb isn't unique, or fingernails aren't unique, or fingerprints aren't unique, or anything about our bodies. Bipedalism isn't unique. Dinosaurs were bipedal, many
right.
of them. So birds are bipedal. So
right.
So even in our bodies, you could say there are all these things that we could say make us human, but it's only because they're put together in a certain way.
And really, you know, looking at anything like that, it's really an arbitrary decision as far, and I think that's one of the things that we show in the book is that, you know, you can draw a line, you know, if human is just kind of having a sort of awareness and caring about other people in the society, that shows up early on in our book, or if it's language, that shows up at a different point, or if it's this level of culture, that is a little bit later on, but really it's kind of a mosaic that comes together.
Mm-hmm. That's
and,
a great word, mosaic.
You know, rather than one specific feature you can find, we're just kind of getting there piecemeal.
Yeah, that's very well said, the whole idea of the mosaic evolution.
Right.
Matt Selesky, as an artist, you were not only working with science, but you're illustrating a book. And I was wondering, were you looking at all or thinking about the very earliest art, for example, cave drawings and things like that?
Yeah, that certainly factors into it, and I think that there are images in each chapter that Anne has actually worked in some of the craft or the technology from each of these groups. So we do show a little bit of the art, if art is the right word, from each of these cultures. Whether it's you know the simplest of stone tools to you know these really wonderful clay figurines that show up later on in the. Doni Vestinice chapter that, you know, based on the pieces of pottery that they found there, or I guess pottery is acceptable, animal
ceramics.
Figurines, ceramics, they must have had this really strong cultural impact that Anne works in the story. And so part of, it's not just reconstructing the figures, but taking these early pieces of ceramics and reconstructing what they might have looked like before they were broken or exploded in the kiln and buried. That was a lot of fun.
You invented some really sweet ones.
Oh, thanks.
And one of my favorite scenes in the book is, I don't know if you have it in that little collection you've got, is the one where all the Neanderthals getting his, the Neanderthals getting his face painted.
Oh, right.
So the early use of ochre.
Right.
And what were they using it for? We have no idea. but
base painting. Well, and that's where, these artifacts and these little pieces of a puzzle survive, and then in a work which is a work of fiction, of narrative, mm-hmm. you can make some guesses.
You can make, that's what they are. They're hypotheses, really.
And just jumping back, you have the picture of the Neanderthal hunting scene out, and that was kind of a fun story. I just wanted to talk about that one specifically a little bit, because I'd sort of done the sketches and worked up a painting and sent images to Anne, and then Anne got back to me and said, there's actually been studies done about how Neanderthals would have held their spears, whether they have this overhand throw or more of an underhand jabbing.
Right.
And I had done a pretty much all one way, and there was some scientific debate. So
you put them both in.
I went back and I repainted the position of a lot of the arms and spears in that painting to kind of make it acceptable or split the difference between the two competing theories of Neanderthal hunting techniques.
Indeed. And that was again an accommodation to the faces standing behind me looking over my shoulder at this work. So, we are not going to just have it one way.
Right.
and you did. That was a beautiful adaptation. It's a really pretty scene.
Anne Weaver is a paleoanthropologist and author of the new book, Children of Time, Becoming Human. Matt Selesky is a natural history illustrator, and he is the illustrator of this book. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank
you. It was fun, as usual. Thank you, Charlotte.